So last time we discussed the possible sectors which contribute to the Hilbert space of free fermions, BC Gauss and so on for the Walsh theory, and the criteria which one has to select some sectors to build a consistent theory. Right, so we had an SNS sector, NSR, RNS, RR. And they were distinguished by the boundary conditions that the fermions have when going around the cylinder. The fermions and the superghosts. So the NS sector is built out of some ground state. And we also add the ground state for the ghosts and super ghosts. And, well, maybe we should allow momentum. And this state has the property that L0 eigenvalues, I mean, we just start from this guy. Well, why not? Let me put the T2. So it's P square over 2 minus 1/2. So the ground state in the bosonic string, the ground state for the ghosts gave you an L0 of minus 1. On top of which you build with the matter fields. Here, because there is also a contribution from the super ghost, the ground state ends up having dimension minus 1/2. Now, in the NS sector, the stress tensor is expanded in modes which are still integral. The supercurrent gives you modes which are the same for the fermions, which means they are half integrals. So remember the modes of the stress tensor were built out of roughly the bosons. And then there is a contribution also from the fermions. Which looks like this. The supercurrent was something like psi dx. It was built out of fermion and bosons. And so it will take a form like this. Actually, let me write it like that. So in the NS sector, the fermions are half integral moded, and so is the supercurrent. In the Raman sector, the fermions have integer modes, and so does the supercurrent. So in the NS sector, your physical states will have to be killed by LNs with positive Ns and by GNs with positive N. And then there will be a condition like L0 or the physical states equal to 0. There are no 0 modes for G to worry about. On the other hand, in the Raman sector, the G's are integral valued, integral moded. So now we'll have both a condition like L0 physical state equal to zero, but also G0 physical states equal to zero. And actually this one implies this, because G0 squared is L0. The central charge, total central charge vanishes. So this condition gives us typically on shell condition, tells that P squared equal to something. Right? This condition, well, G0 includes in particular A0 psi 0 plus dot dots. And when it acts on ground state, on momentum modes, so this acts as P, right? And this acts as a gamma matrix. So this sort of condition will typically give us something like a Dirac equation, the first order constraint instead of a second order constraint. So this will give us something like P plus dot 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 equal to zero, while this will give us P squared plus dot 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 equal to zero. And of course, anyway, so here in the next sector, right, I start building my states. With oscillators, the thing that raises the energy the least are the psi minus 1/2 modes of the fermions. And then of course afterwards you can get things like I minus 1 mu, I minus 1 bar mu, or A minus 1 mu psi minus 1 psi bar minus 1/2 mu psi bar minus 3/2 mu. Okay, so that's true. And so on. There will be a lot of possible things I can build. But because the Casimir energy was minus 1/2, these are the massless states. This will give rise to the massless states. There is a tachyon, potentially. There is the massless states with two indices, which give us usual graviton, B field, and dilaton, and then massive states. And in type 2A or type 2B, this is projected out. And we just have these massless modes. And of course, a whole bunch of other things will be projected out. But you still have an infinite tower of massive string states. Now, in the NSR sector, now we'll have to take into account the action of the zero modes of the fermions. As I discussed yesterday, this means that the basic states on which I build everything will carry spinor representations, either chiral or anti-chiral spinors. So in 10 dimensions, in 9 plus 9.1 dimensions, there are Majorana Weyl spinors, which are 16 real components, and are chiral or anti-chiral. So this index runs from 1 to 16, and so does this. Now, these guys already have L0 equal to P squared over 2. I'm missing space. What I want to say. Sorry. On the NS side, we still have L0 equal to P squared over 2 minus 1/2. But on the Ramon side, there is a shift in the dimension. You remember, for example, in the Ising model, the Ramon sectors, the sigma field, had dimension 1/16. Just because somehow the Casimir energy of periodic fermions is different from the Casimir energy of antiperiodic fermions. If you have 10 fermions, you'll get 10 over 16. And then there is another contribution from the Gauss, which brings it back down to 8 over 16. So just by virtue of being on the Ramon sector, there is an extra 1/2. Which means that to get good states, we need to act with something on the homomorphic side, but we don't need to do anything on the anti-homomorphic side. And so these will give us massless states. And then there will be some type of massive modes. Similarly, here I'll have something like psi bar mu minus 1/2 pa m psi bar minus 1/2 mu pa dot, and then stuff. But these are going to be the massless modes. And finally, on the Ramon-Ramon side, I have states with two indices, two spinor indices, one from the left movers, one from the right movers. So this is acted by the psi zeros, this is acted by the psi bar zeros. Now, the distinction between A, type 2A and type 2B is basically based on the question, which of these has fermion minus 1 to the F left, or minus 1 to the F right, 1, and which one has minus 1. So remember, the GSO projection, the rule to decide which states to keep or not keep for type 2A string was that there are these quantum numbers, minus 1 to the F left, and minus 1 to the F right, and we want them both to be 1 instead of minus 1. Right, the tachyon had minus 1 to the F left equal to minus 1 to the F right equal to minus 1, so it was thrown away. Acting with psi, we get something with fermion number 1. Here, this state still has minus 1 to the F left equal to minus 1, which gets fixed when we act with psi. But we need to decide what are the charges under minus 1 to the F right. Because the action of the zero modes maps one into the other and back, one of them will have 1 and the other minus 1. Now, there is a certain amount of freedom in the sense I can always take my spacetime and reverse the definition of chirality. So this choice is pretty much immaterial, but the relative choice between what we do here and what we do here matters. So there will be a theory where the ones that we keep have the same chirality. That's called type 2B. So in type 2B, you would keep, say, these and these. While in type 2A, you would keep these and these. Okay. Any questions? Probably yes. Do you have any questions that you would want to voice? Okay. So type 2B is a chiral theory. It has fields of one chirality and not the other. This kind of works only because these spin or representations are real. Right? If they were complex, then we would always have to include the complex conjugates, which would be the other chirality, typically. Now, these fields that we are keeping, so what are their properties? Well, they have one vector and one spinor index. Right? And they satisfy a first-order differential equation, because they have to be annihilated by G0. So this equation roughly looks like this, like a Dirac equation. So these kind of fields are called gravitinis, the spin 3/2. As I mentioned before, having a gravitino in the spectrum pretty much implies that you are a theory of supergravity, that you have a local supersymmetry in space-time, which extends the group of diffeomorphism for space-time. So although we started with supersymmetry on the worksheet, in type 2a and type 2b, we find an emergent supersymmetry in space-time. Now, there happen to be, so there are 16 gravitinis here and 16 gravitinis here, for a total of 32. So we have a theory with 32 supersymmetries in space-time. 32 turns out to be the maximum amount of supersymmetry you can have in a theory of gravity. In a quantum field theory, you can have up to 16. This is because just by, you know, when you look at multiplets for supersymmetry, they tend to, you know, the more supersymmetries you have, the more new indices you can attach to a field by acting with supersymmetries on it. So if you have too many supersymmetries, you end up with fields that have too many indices, which are high spin fields. But there are no interacting massless higher spin field theories. So if you are OK with spins of fields of spin 2, then you have a theory of supergravity. And that allows you to have up to 32 supercharges. If you have fields of, if you want only quantum field theories, so spins, fields of spin up to 1, then you can only work with up to 16 supersymmetries. So Max Hellman supersymmetric quantum field theory is a theory with 16 supersymmetries and gauge fields. And it's called the Nicole Four superior Mills in 4 dimensions, and in general, supersymmetric Mills in any dimension. Theories with 32 supercharges are maximal supergravities. They exist in various dimensions. And in 10 dimensions, there are exactly 2, type 2a and type 2b. So these 2 string theories at low energy give you the only 2 maximal supersymmetric supergravities in 10 dimensions. This is convenient because at some point, some people which had a passion for that found the action of supergravities in 10 dimensions. So that tells you automatically, which is unique because of supersymmetry. So that tells you automatically the low energy effective action for these string theories, pretty much. So if you open Polchinski volume 2, it starts with the action for these supergravities. And in particular, the supersymmetries somehow are going to mix up together all the massless fields of your theory. Everything is very constrained. Now, in the Ramon sector, which kind of, so again, we have 4 states which have all possible 4 eigenvalues for for minus 1 to df left and minus 1 for df right. So we'll keep only 1 of them. For type 2a, we keep the one which choose, sorry, with one, sorry, we keep this in the notations I've been using, which are probably not great. In type 2b, we keep this. So these are massless fields with 2 spinor indices. And they have a funny property because they are annihilated by both G0 and G0 bar. So it's like they are killed by 2 Dirac equations. one acting on one index and the other acting on the other index independently. That looks very strange. Can you think of any situation where you have ever encountered fields which satisfy two sets of linear equations instead of one quadratic equation? Some of you might have them written on some t-shirt. That's right. Maxwell equations are an example of such equations. If you write in terms of forms, they look like this. In components, they're a little bit pastier, right? Something like the mu f sigma tau plus cyclic permutations equal to zero, and the mu f mu nu equal to zero, right? Now, it turns out that in any dimension, there is a relation between objects with two spinor indices and objects with antisymmetric combinations of vector indices. So in general, if you look at all at which representations of the Lorentz group sit inside a product of two spinors, you will find all the antisymmetric tensors. For example, in four dimensions, if you have some object which has spinor indices of opposite chirality, this has four components, two times two, and can be identified with a vector. If you try to write down equations like this with Dirac operators which act individually on each index, these become equations like this, the mu f nu minus the nu f mu equal to zero, and the mu f mu equal to zero. So this is essentially telling you that f mu is the mu of some phi, and this is telling you that the square phi is zero. Now, if you look at something with two indices of the same type, you have two choices. One is to take it antisymmetric in the two indices, but that's boring. You get some field which satisfies this silly equation. A constant scalar field, not very interesting. But if you take a symmetric combination of two indices, that's a self-dual true form. So it's some f mu nu which satisfies f mu nu equal to star epsilon mu nu sigma tau f sigma tau, maybe an I. For them in 3+1 dimension. And in 3+1 dimension, spinors are complex, right? So it's natural to combine something like this with something like this. They give you the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. So together, they give you an f mu nu. So this contains something like electric field plus IB field, and this electric field minus IB field. And the Dirac equations for these guys become the Maxwell equations once you write them out. So the way you go from things with two spinor indices to things with antisymmetric vector indices is essentially by looking at products of gamma matrices. So these are objects with two spinor indices and a certain number of vector indices. So in each dimension, you can do the exercise of decomposing products of spinors into vectors and antisymmetric powers. So if you do it in 10 dimensions, What do you find? Well, the product of two spinners of different type contains, well, a scalar, but a kind of boring scalar like that. Contains a true form, a four forms, and that's it. Now we could check if this is sensible exercise. If you take the binomials 10, 0, plus 10, 2, plus 10, 4, compare them with 16 squared. Here, if you decompose this, we find something with one index, which something with three indices, antisymmetric, and something with five indices, a self-dual top. So something which satisfies an equation like that, except no I because it's a real representation, and 10. 10 indices in your epsilon tensor. So, in other words, in type 2A, there is a constant scalar. Usually it's ignored, although sometimes it can play an interesting role. A standard gauge field and a three-form gauge field. So this comes from, you can think about this as being D of some A mu. And this has been day of something with three indices. So this is something that naturally couples to lines, to word lines, to particles of some sort. And this is something that naturally couples to membranes of some sort. In type 2b, we have a scalar field called the axion. We have something naturally couples to strings, and something naturally couples to four-dimensional objects. Now, I say that they couple naturally to things, but if you look at scattering amplitudes or at the effective action, you will find that these gauge fields do not carry charge, that no string states, massless or massive, carry charges for these fields. So the strings themselves are charged under the B field, not under any of these Ramon-Ramon fields. But when you start looking at D-brains, then you find that some of the D-brains are indeed charged under these gauge fields. Indeed, when you look at D-brains in type 2A or in type 2B, you find that in each of these theories, half of the D-brains have a tachyon on the word volume. And they decay, they are not interesting. The other half do not have a tachyon, they are stable, and they carry charges for these Ramon fields. Now, the two facts are clearly related because if you carry charges and nothing else in your theory carries those charges, you cannot decay. So it makes sense that they have no tachyon. So, parallel to this statement, there is a statement that type 2A and type 2B have had the following brains. Type 2A has a D0 brain, which is a particle that couples to F mu electrically. It has a D2 brain, which is a membrane and couples electrically to this field. It has a D4 brain, which couples magnetically to this field. So it sources magnetic flux instead of sourcing electric field. And then there is a D6 brain, which couples magnetically to F mu. There is also something called the D8 brain, which shifts the value of this F. It's like a domain wall in space-time across which f shifts by one unit. But it has all sorts of strange features. It exists, it can be used. In type 3, well, there is an instanton, but let me also ignore that. There is a D1 brain, which couples electrically to this field. A D3 brain, which couples to the self-dual 5 form. A D5 brain, which couples magnetically to this. And a D7 brain, which couples to the axion. There is also a D9 brain, which fills space-time and is used to produce these type 1 theories. So these are all stable D-brains. And they're really part of your theory. So let me see, what other information do I need to give about this? Well, one fun thing is that, you know, D-brains are quantized sources, right? So these are quantized sources for these Ramon fields. And electric and magnetic D-brains are properly quantized. So this brain has precisely the minimum possible magnetic charge compatible with electric charge of this. So they satisfy Dirac quantization, which is also nice. What else do you want to know about this? I mean, I can sketch some of the dualities that this theory satisfies. But before doing that, I would like to see what other perturbative information could be interesting. Well, one piece of information is that T-duality is still working. So you can put either of these theories on a circle and ask what happens when the circle becomes small. And T-duality exchanges type 2A and type 2B. So if you take type 2A, you put it on a small circle, you will find type 2B on a large circle. So these theories are definitely related in a direct way. So what happens is that when you put the theory in a circle, then you can take your brains and you can either wrap them on the circle or not wrap them on the circle. And then if you wrap them on the circle, they get related to the D-brain with one dimension lower. And if you do not wrap them, they get related to the... So something wrapped here becomes something not wrapped here, or something not wrapped here becomes something wrapped here. So some of these dualities were already somehow expected from supergravity, morally speaking. Well, so let me say it properly. In supergravity, if you take supergravity and you put it on a circle and you do a dimensional reduction, meaning that you throw away all Kazusa-Klein modes, you get a nine-dimensional theory of supergravity. And indeed, it's the case that type 2A supergravity and type 2B supergravity on a circle give you the same nine-dimensional theory. This theory has some extra scalar field which tell you the radius of the circle, and the action is invariant under scalar, radius goes to 1 over radius. Well, in not invariant, I mean, it's the type 2A quantification and type 2B quantification are related at that. But in string theory, of course, there is a stronger statement that when you put the theory in a circle, you don't throw away the Kaluza-Klein modes. Instead, you gain extra winding modes, which allow the symmetry to still work. So that's one thing I could say. If you put these theories on tori, you get generalizations of the T-duality, which are called U-dualities. And anyway, They they don't add anything particularly interesting. What are more interesting are the non-perturbative dualities, which I would like to discuss. So now, on the type 2B side, if you look at the action which is fixed by supergravity, so that there is a specific action for this dilaton and axion. Actually, in type 2B, it's natural to combine the dilaton and the axion into something like axion plus e to the minus dilaton, roughly. I'm not normalizing it properly. So let me just actually write it, like, you know. So this is the coupling, of course, the coupling. The dilaton can be absorbed into the coupling. Now, if you write down the supergravity action, it turns out that the tau naturally lives in the upper half plane. And the action is completely is invariant under isometries of the upper half plane seen as the Poincaré plane. So there is a natural metric on the target space of these maps, something like the tau bar over imaginary part of tau squared. And now there is a nice SL2R symmetry acting on this. Now this is not a symmetry to supergravity. It's not a full symmetry of string theory, but people notice that if you include D-brains, everything seems to be invariant under some discrete transformations in SL2Z. So for example, there is a transformation that sends tau to 1 over tau, and in particular makes the weak coupling, exchanges weak coupling and strong coupling, and which permutes the fundamental strings and the D-brains and the D-strings. So the tension of these D1 brains goes like 1 over the coupling. In terms of in Planck units, somehow the tension of a string and the tension of a D1 brain are inverse of each other. So as you make your strings more strongly coupled and the tension grows with respect to the Planck scale, the tension of the D-brain, or the D1 brains, goes down. And at some point, they switch. So type 2B at strong coupling seems to be equivalent to type 2B at weak coupling. Now, of course, you cannot do most calculations at strong coupling. So you can think about this as a way to discover how strong coupling looks like. Some properties are protected from quantum corrections because of supersymmetry. Properties like the tension of the string, of the D1 string, versus the tension of the fundamental string. So this is what allows you to conjecture, at least, that there is this S-duality. So this is called S-duality. Now, another observation that is interesting is that instead, if you look at type 2A, a strong coupling, the D0 brains are becoming light. So you're getting some light particles in the spectrum. Now, type 2A supergravity happens to look like the reduction in a circle of 11-dimensional supergravity. At some point, Witten noticed that the D0 brains behave pretty much like Kaluza-Klein modes of a graviton in 11 dimensions. And there follows the conjecture that type 2a, when the string coupling becomes large, should be identified with some 11-dimensional theory, which was dubbed M theory. Which has just supergravity and some very heavy other things. So that is supergravity all the way to the Planck scale where stuff happens that is outside our control. So from that point of view, that the zero brains becomes Kaluza-Klein modes, the D2 brain is an, both the D2 brain and the fundamental string are unified as coming from a two-dimensional object, called, from a membrane. If you wrap it on the circle, you're supposed to get a fundamental string in type 2a. If you don't, you don't. So here there is a radius of compactification, which is supposed to be something like 1 over the coupling. No, sorry, the coupling times some powers of the Planck constant. Very roughly. And both the D4 brain and something else which I have not mentioned called an S5 brain come from a six-dimensional object called an S5 brain, and so on. Anyway, there is a dictionary. I can perhaps also mention that this duality, this relation, NS duality, are compatible with each other in the sense that if you take type 2a on a circle, that can be related to M theory on the product of two circles. But this is supposed to be is related by T-duality to type 2b on a circle. Now, the S-duality of this type 2b maps to the exchange, the permutation of these two circles in M theory. So not only you get a whole bunch of dualities, as both perturbative and non-perturbative, but they are all consistent with each other. So this is what convinced people that there should be some underlying structure that relates all of these string theories, and which could make non-perturbative sense. Although understanding the structure has been elusive. So we have no idea of how to provide a non-perturbative definition of any of these theories on a generic background. We don't even know if that question makes sense, which is very puzzling. Somehow, in particle physics, we got used to the idea that the new structure appears only at small scales, right? You have some theory, maybe if you dig deeper in scale, you'll get a more refined theory. But all you need to do is to look at shorter and shorter distances. Somehow, gravity theories of quantum gravity seem to be more complicated. And the global structure of space-time seems to matter as much as the microscopic structure for the purpose of giving a non-perturbative definition of your theory. I don't know much. I don't know really what to say about it, except that these are the sort of lessons that seem to come out from holography, from the little we know about string theory. Non-perturbatively. Now, do you have any questions? Now is the time to just ask whatever question will pass through your mind. We have 15 minutes, and I think I presented all the basic material I wanted to present.
How do you know it couples magnetically or electrically to these?
So you do the calculation you do this sort of calculation where you consider a cylinder and you put your boundary condition. So you take your deep brain here, and you look which state it produces. And, you know, you get something like this with some function of the momentum in front. And you look what this is. And you find, oh, this is an electric field that goes like 1 over distance to some power. Oh, this is a magnetic field that goes like 1 over distance to some power. With some charges. Then, of course, you can also do calculations on a strip. Right. To try to find the spectrum of open strings. And it turns out that when you're on a strip, for open strings, there are only 2 sectors, like an S and R. So here you get your the mass states that have 1 index, so the usual gauge field. Or position fluctuation. And in the Ramon sector, you get something with a single Spinor index. Which gives you a gauge, you know, gives you a fermion, which is a supersymmetric partner of the gauge field. So the theory of the Worst volume theory on the deep brains is precisely this maximally supersymmetric Jan-Mills theory I mentioned. So it's the unique theory which has 16 supersymmetries. Right, this is something I should have mentioned. Deep brains are half BPS objects. So when you look at a supersymmetry algebra in any dimension, it looks roughly like this. So you have supercharges with anti-commute translations. Okay. Now, if you want to have a D-brain, right? A D-brain is an object that sits at some position in space-time and extends along some other positions. So a D-brain clearly breaks some translations. As a consequence, it has to break some of the supersymmetries. So it turns out that the deep brains preserve 16 out of 32 supersymmetries. And which makes sense also because the volume theory of the deep brains is a field theory. So it makes sense that it can have only up to 16 supercharges. And because it's a maximal field theory, it's completely fixed. So if you have a single deep brain or multiple deep brains stacked on top of each other, you get these maximal supersymmetric. Jan-Mills theory. For example, on D3 brains, you find the maximal supersymmetric four-dimensional Jan-Mills theory. The S transformation of type 2B sends D3 brains to back to themselves, and it implies a quantum field theory statement that so maximal supersymmetric gauge theory in 4 dimensions has a coupling, which is a marginal coupling. And S-duality implies that there is an S-duality for this coupling in the quantum field theory. This is a very deep property of the supersymmetric quantum field theory. And it means that we can understand this quantum field theory at arbitrarily large coupling. Indeed, the Nicol 4 supermills in 4 dimensions is probably the best candidate for a fully solvable quantum field theory. We're not there yet, but Pedro has been working hard and his collaborators. Conversely, holography allows you to express type 2B in anti-de Sitter space in terms of this four-dimensional gauge theory at large n. And so if you believe as duality for the gauge theory, it implies as duality for type 2B. Kind of goes both ways. Any other questions?
So now you mentioned holography, there's this argument that when you have a theory which has dynamical gravity, so the entropy inside a volume can scale maximally as the sort of area. Is this, so the fact that these degrees of freedom are strings rather than points, does that help in any way with this argument? Or?
I'm not sure. Holography is not, so you can have holography without strings. For example, there are quantum field theories whose holographic dual is an M theory space-time, and there are no strings. So, so I will be cautious in trying to attribute properties of holography to properties of strings. Right, so there is this theory called ABGM theory, which is a three-dimensional supersymmetric gauge theory whose dual is M theory in ADS4 times it. Year. That's a seven. Right, unfortunately, we do not know how to define. Sorry, M theory has no perturbative regime. Because, see, so string theory had the dilaton, and then there was the Planck scale. But you traded the dilaton for a radius of a circle. So you have no dilaton anymore. There is no scale, no massless coupling. In M theory, there is only the Planck scale. That's the only parameter. So you.
But, so do you have a non perturbative description of?
No.
Just.
That's right. Well, if you sit in a specific space-time, like ADS4 times S7, then there is a holographic description. There is also some very weird description involving compactification in a light cone direction and some matrix model, which in principle should allow one to compute scattering amplitudes of gravitons perturbatively in your dimensions, but I don't think anybody has been here. Has managed to do the calculation.
And is it based on a flat metric
it's a flat metric where a light cone direction has been made compact. It's a weird description. I never understood it very well.
So it's a supergravity theory, you're saying? So, but you don't have the metric is not dynamical, right?
Yeah, it's dynamical.
But coming from the flat metric, you don't have.
No, I mean, you can define M theory in a variety of. So, through holography, you can define a theory on space times which have certain asymptotic boundary conditions. So if you have a space-time that asymptotically looks like ADS times a sphere, then you can define M theory in the space-time. The metric inside will be dynamic. Right. And you know, besides the fact that, of course, there is also the matter that you don't know how to quantize membranes, and there are no strings, but. The lack of a perturbation parameter is more serious. Any more questions?
So we computed the spectrum of one string, right?
Yes.
And the spectrum of the full theory is going to just going to be a Fock space of all these states we computed, right?
Perturbatively, yes.
What exactly do you mean by perturbatively?
The same thing as I would say in quantum field theory, made more serious by the fact that there are also things like black holes. So when things get non-perturbative, they get seriously non-perturbative. So. I mean, presumably, the space of states of string theory includes a black hole sitting somewhere and moving at some speed. You will not be able to see it in the in the Fock space. Also some very special black holes, like very supersymmetric black holes, might appear as D brains. I mean, like if you have a quantum field theorite and you treat it perturbatively, you know, you could say that, you know, the Fock, the Hilbert space is a Fock space of a bunch of elementary fields, right? But then in practice, more complicated things can happen, right? You might get bound states, you might get the spectrum will have corrections. You know, all of these string modes are, all the massive string modes are unstable to decay to lighter strings. So if you do things in a full theory, they will become resonances. So even perturbatively at loops, the mass square of this particle will be moved away from the real axis. But I guess that at some point these resonances become wide enough that you don't distinguish them as particles anymore. On the other hand, you might get new things. So, right, so the calculation we did answers questions which are in a way that is correct as long as you are in a perturbative regime. You know, the weaker is your coupling, the better are the answers. But, you know, I don't know how interested one is in studying weak strings weakly propagating in a 10-dimensional spacetime. For physics, that's not a terribly useful universe. People who do string phenomenology try to see, the point is that it's likely that string theory has a lot of interesting vacua configurations which look like four-dimensional universe but are outside perturbation theory. We have very little control on those. We know very little about them. And people just with the purpose of producing examples, try to set up configurations which remain weakly coupled and they still describe four-dimensional universe. I don't know what's, you know. But it's still not completely clear that because you have no control on non-perturbative phenomena, it's really hard to make any useful prediction on the nature and evolution of such systems. So there are two challenges. So at the perturbative level, in order to describe strings moving in complicated configurations, you might need a good control on the worksheet theory. The worksheet theory might not be free. So as our understanding of two-dimensional quantum field theory progresses, our understanding of perturbative string theory will progress analogously. For example, and this is useful for a variety of applications. For example, if you want to study QCD, in the large N, in the large number of colors, QCD has definitely a string dual. Problem is that it's probably a string moving in a very curved spacetime, where it's a weakly coupled string, but still moving in a background for which the worksheet theory is not free. So these are sort of questions for which any improvement in two-dimensional quantum field theory will lead to improvement in string theory. But the question of what to do non-perturbatively in string theory, well, that's much harder. It's a question for string theory, it's a question for quantum gravity in general. So people have been spending quite some time now trying to extract every possible lesson we can learn from holography. Even though holography itself applies to spacetimes which do not look like our spacetime at all. So nobody has really a clue what to do in cosmological spacetimes. So those questions are wide open. Now, so the recent interest in applying information theory to quantum gravity seems to be in this direction. I don't know how far it will go. So there are deep questions. There are no obvious way. There are no obvious routes on how to solve them at the moment. These are really the deep questions. Personally, I find deeply intriguing this fact that holography gives non-perturbative definitions of these theories, which depend on the global structure of space-time. It still confuses me deeply, because you would think that non-perturbative. Okay, it just goes against the grain of what people thought of. How to define a theory of everything for a long while. Right? For a while, the theory of everything, from the particle physicist perspective, was just dig deeper at shorter and shorter scales until you get something self-consistent. But string theory does not seem to be pointing in that direction. There is no non-perturbative definition which forgets about the global structure of space-time. But I don't know what to do with that lesson. Okay.
Thanks, David.